If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
UAI North Island, Sacramento.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, President Trump opens the door for more chips that power AI to head to China. We'll look at what it means for the global race for AI dominance.
And to meet rising demand for AI, nuclear power plants that had been retired are coming back.
What we're doing here is exciting. Having a reliable power source that keeps your electricity costs as low, everybody should be rooting for that.
Plus, rural Albany, Georgia is home to a sprawling hospital system, but that hasn't brought down the cost of care.
I mean, it was sort of second or third to resort areas like Vail, Colorado, and Aspen.
Coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump plans to speak to public worries about high prices and affordability when he holds a campaign-style rally in a swing congressional district of Pennsylvania today. One big concern among voters surrounds Affordable Care Act subsidies due to expire in a few weeks. The health policy news source KFF reports millions of people who have coverage through the ACA marketplace stand to see their out-of-pocket premium payments more than double next year. President Trump was asked about health care in an interview with Politico's Dasha Burns.
I'd like to get better health care. I'd like to have people buy their own health care, get much better health care. And what I want to do, very simple, I want to give the money to the people, not to the insurance companies.
So right now people are buying their holiday presents. They're planning.
Look, don't be dramatic.
No.
Don't be dramatic.
They're planning their budgets for next year,
here's
Mr.
What I
President.
I know. And what I want to do is help them.
Trump argues ACA or Obamacare was set up to make insurance companies rich. When asked if he plans to tell Congress to extend the subsidies while he works out an alternative, Trump said he would have to see. The ACLU and other rights groups are suing for the immediate release of the still-secret Justice Department memo justifying the administration's lethal strikes against suspected drug boats, NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the New York Civil Liberties Union filed their lawsuit in federal court in Manhattan. They want the administration to make public the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel's memo and other documents related to the Trump administration's lethal targeting of suspected drug boats. The lawsuit says disclosing these records is, quote, critically important to ensuring informed public debate about the U.S. military's unprecedented strikes, which the suit says are a clear violation of domestic and international law. The administration says the strikes are legal and aim to combat the illicit drug trade. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Google is the target of a second European Union investigation in less than a month. Officials are looking at how the tech giant uses other people's online content to train its artificial intelligence models. Terry Schultz has more from Brussels.
The European Commission says it suspects Google of creating its AI-generated summaries with content generated by others, such as publishers or YouTube users, who are not compensated nor offered the option to refuse. European Commission spokesperson Ariana Podesta says this could mean Google is taking unfair advantage of its dominant position as a search engine
by imposing unfair terms to the publishers of this content or by granting itself some privileged access to the information.
Google has already rejected the complaint by independent publishers, which led to the investigation. Last month, the commission opened an antitrust probe into indications Google is unfairly demoting news and publishing websites in search results when they include content from commercial partners. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Paul Lancour. Negotiations between striking teachers and the West Contra Costa School District are set to resume today. KQED's Aya Ali Ahmad spoke to teachers and parents yesterday outside district headquarters.
Hundreds of educators, parents, and students rallied in Richmond to urge the district to return to the bargaining table. Erica Cheval is a parent in the district.
Our teachers want to be back with our students. And the district is the only thing getting in the way. Enough is enough.
Union leaders say the district has been stalling, but officials say they've invited teachers back to the negotiating table. Sasha Hahn is a student at El Cerrito High.
And every day that the district doesn't negotiate with our teachers is another day that us as students are being neglected.
Teachers are asking for substantial raises to address what they call a staffing crisis. I'm Aya Ali Mott, KQED News.
Oakland is reinstating a position that oversees public funding for the arts. In June, the City Council approved a budget that made several cuts, including doing away with the Cultural Affairs Manager role, prompting protests by artists and activists. Earlier this month, the Oakland Side reports the council voted to reinstate the position. The city's Cultural Affairs Manager helps run a volunteer board that advises Oakland on policy issues affecting artists, and they secure external funding for the arts. In sports, the Sharks will visit the Flyers in Philadelphia at 4 our time. I'm Paul Lancour, KQED News.
Afternoon support comes from Oakland's San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And the listeners of KQED. Tuesday afternoon forecast for the Sacramento Valley. Mostly cloudy skies the rest of today. Some areas of afternoon fog still around. Highs 44 to 52. Cloudy tonight. Fog returning overnight. Lows 39 to 45. A mix of afternoon clouds and sun now for the Bay Area with highs in the 50s to the 60s. Look for cloudy skies, areas of patchy fog returning, dense after midnight.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. And there's lots of reaction today across the country to President Trump's announcement that he's going to let the American chip maker NVIDIA sell its second most powerful chip, the H200, to China. Getting access to these chips, which produce the incredible level of computation needed to make advanced artificial intelligence, is a big win for China. The country trails behind the U.S. in the AI race. It's also a win for NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang, who's been lobbying the Trump administration to loosen years of restrictions on chip sales, restrictions meant to block China's access to advanced American technology. Chris Miller is author of Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology. And Chris, the Biden administration feared giving the chips would buy China time to make its own chips. Mr. Huang told the president limiting access only encouraged China to make its own chips. Sounds like he made his case.
Well, that's right. I think the White House has become convinced that selling these ultra-advanced chips to China is in the U.S. interest. I think there's a lot of debate around this, both in Silicon Valley and in Washington, D.C., where there's recognition that China today can't produce similar quality chips at anywhere near the quantity that China's AI ambitions require. And so right now, China is really struggling to produce and acquire the AI computational capacity that its data centers need.
Yeah, well, some also think U.S. restrictions may have pushed China to try to create AI systems with fewer and cheaper chips. The Chinese company DeepSeek claimed it did that. Might that have been motivation for the president?
Well, I think that argument's been certainly brought up in debates in Washington, but actually if you dig into the evidence and look, for example, at the latest model that DeepSeek released just at the start of this month, what you find is that DeepSeek has been struggling to reach the cutting edge that companies like Google and OpenAI and Anthropic can, and they publicly say it's because they don't have access to the computing power they need to do comparable levels of training of their models. So in other words, even DeepSeek is saying this high-end compute really matters, and they don't have enough of it.
Right. Well, what about concerns about national security? President Trump said on social media the U.S. will allow approved customers in China to buy these chips under conditions that allow for continued strong national security. So what does that mean?
Well, we don't really know yet. The administration hasn't released details as to what these national security restrictions might entail. I think there's two types of national security concerns. Number one is that there is a pretty well-established track record of the People's Liberation Army getting access to cutting-edge U.S. chips whenever they cross the border into China and use them for military purposes. But the second broader concern is that anything that enhances the capabilities of China's overall AI ecosystem makes it more likely that the leading tech firms of the AI era come from China. And that would enhance, if it happens, China's capabilities for surveillance, for exerting leverage by centering Chinese firms in the tech ecosystem. And that's why both Republicans and Democrats have been skeptical of the argument that we should be giving cutting-edge computing chips to enable China's AI advances.
Yeah. Well, the president also confirmed that the U.S. will get a cut of the sales. So he's lobbied to clear the way for the deal by Huang, a private company, and then his government will get a cut. Is that even legal?
Well, I think there's been debate among legal scholars as to whether that's an export tax, which the Constitution prohibits, or whether it's a fee, which might be legal. I think from my perspective, either way, the dollars involved aren't that large relative to the implications for AI leadership. And so if you think like I do that AI is going to be a multi-trillion dollar economic opportunity over the coming decades, a couple of billion dollars in the short run is probably not worth valuing very highly in comparison to the question of long-run leadership.
Well, but we still have to point out, you know, that maybe the president already got a cut because NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang has confirmed he's one of the donors to Trump's ballroom renovation at the White House. Feels like quid pro quo to some, but you argue that at the least it's a great deal for NVIDIA, but maybe hurts other U.S. companies?
Well, I think that's right. I think the companies that sell chips like NVIDIA obviously want looser regulations when it comes to chip sales. But if that enables Chinese cloud computing companies and Chinese AI model developers, that creates more competition for other firms in Silicon Valley. And when you look at most of the U.S. big tech firms, most of the companies at the cutting edge of AI technology, they're major users of these chips, and they want an advantage vis-a-vis their Chinese rivals. And so anything that enhances the capability of Chinese firms to access cutting edge chips creates stronger competitors that U.S. firms have to try to compete against.
Give us a closing thought, Chris Miller. What are you watching?
I think there's been really no doubt that access to computing power is one of the fundamental drivers of AI progress. And until today, the U.S. plus its allies in Taiwan and Korea have really unique capabilities that China today and next year and the year after won't be able to match. And so we should think very carefully about who gets to access these advanced chips.
Chris Miller, author of Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology, will continue this conversation in the future. Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, President Trump is offering an olive branch to farmers hit by his global trade war. Yesterday at the White House, he announced a $12 billion bailout.
So what we're doing is we're taking a relatively small portion of that, and we're going to be giving and providing it to the farmers in economic assistance. And we love our farmers. And as you know, the farmers like me.
After the president announced his tariffs earlier this year, China responded with a boycott of American soybeans, and that hit farmers like Caleb Ragland right where it hurts. Caleb is president of the American Soybean Association. Welcome back.
Good to be here, Peter. Thank you.
You know, You know, the president's been talking about this bailout for several months. I know a lot of farmers were eagerly awaiting the news. How badly do soybean farmers need this money?
Well, Peter, soybean farmers have been in a very tough spot with the loss of the China market. Obviously, we had an agreement here a few weeks ago to bring some of that back. But in numbers, China consumes more soy than the rest of the world combined. They're a vital market. Historically, in the recent years, they have purchased about 25% of all soybeans produced by our U.S. farmers. And here until recent days, we hadn't had any sales from this year's crop to China. And that was an alarming situation, caused our prices to go down. We're already struggling with lower commodity prices and higher input costs than we've ever had. And that combination, coupled with the trade war, has really been tough. So this financial bridge is a start. It's helpful to get us back to where we need to be, but we have losses averaging over $100 an acre, according to our economist, and this financial bridge will come up with maybe a quarter of that, but it's not close to the full financial pain that is going on our soybean farms across the country.
Well, that's that is exactly what I was going to ask you next, you know, whether this bailout would be enough to cover all your losses. Clearly, you're saying it is not. So now what?
Well, what we need more than anything is market-based opportunities from trade and also here at home domestically. One thing that we could do here in the near future is the administration could finalize the RVOs, which is the volume for biofuels for 2026 through 2028. All that proposal likes is just being implemented by the administration. Also, the 45Z tax credit would further help biofuels. And biofuels are just as big of a chunk of our market as exports are. So to China, as export to China are, both are around a quarter of our production. So we have opportunities here at home. We also have opportunities around the world with other markets. We need to make sure that we don't have barriers in place that make us uncompetitive, whether it be in the China market or anywhere else. And the American farmer is resilient and is a great producer. We just need to make sure we have a level playing field.
We've been talking about some of the economic conditions that you're facing. Politically speaking, is this bailout announced by the president enough for farmers like yourself to look past the president's trade policies? I mean, it might help a little economically. What about politically?
Well, I think that farmers tend to look at policy more than politics. And right now, farmers need policy in place that helps them to have an economically sustainable future. And that's really the main concern from the farmers that I talk with. And right now, we have policy challenges because we haven't been competitive with the opportunities around the world. And this recent announcement on China trade is good, but we got to see follow through there. And follow through has not been real strong up to this point. And we want to see follow through. We want to see deliveries. We need to really see cash on the barrel head ultimately from those sales. And I think that is what would probably give more hope than anything to our farmers and kind of rebuild some political concerns.
So that deal you're referring to, back in October, President Trump and President Xi Jinping shook hands. They agreed that China would buy 12 million metric tons of U.S. soybeans by the end of the year. The last, you mentioned this already, but the last time we spoke, you told me that, you know, China had placed zero orders for U.S. soybeans. That was a very big deal for you, as you've been describing. And you mentioned how that has started to pick up a little bit. Why don't we just end there? How much improvement have you seen? What kind of activity from China?
Well, the numbers are showing a little over 2 million metric tons. In recent years, we've averaged around 25 million. The agreement was for 12 million by the end of December. So we've got a long ways to go in a short time to get there. And we desperately need some follow through there. And we want to see greater opportunity in the upcoming year, or we're going to have a lot of farmers that aren't able to stay in business. Again, we need resilient markets and strong opportunity, and we will succeed if we have that.
Caleb Ragland, president of the American Soybean Association, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now.
In Uganda, a program seeks to address poverty by giving cash and financial coaching to people who need it. Now, funding to global development programs like this are being cut.
If we can find a better way of squeezing more juice out of whatever we're doing, then you can expand and help more people. And instead of going to 1,000 communities, we can go to 2,000 communities.
More on those challenges on All Things Considered from NPR News.
More at 1 o'clock coming up on All Things Considered. Holiday season is here, and we want to know how you'll be celebrating. Are you doing anything different this year? Maybe making a new dish or visiting a new place? Share your stories with KQED's Perspectives. Visit kqed.org/perspectives to submit your piece today. Support for KQED comes from El Camino Health. Open enrollment happens once a year. More about which health plans provide access to El Camino Health doctors and nationally recognized hospitals at elcaminohealth.org/openenrollment. And support for KQED's card donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, defending church-state separation and the First Amendment, including freedom of the press, for nearly 80 years. Learn more at au.org.
It's Here and Now. The United States is ravenous for new sources of power, and that's the focus of our climate solutions reporting this week. Today, a closer look at nuclear power, which the United States, rather the White House, has promised to quadruple by 2050. To get there, some closed nuclear plants are coming back online. Here and Now's Chris Bentley visited two of them.
The Palisades Nuclear Generating Station is nestled between sand dunes on the eastern shore of Lake Michigan. It shut down for financial reasons in 2022, but you wouldn't know it now with hundreds of workers streaming through its security barriers every day. Palisades is on track to reopen early next year, and when it does, it'll be the first time that's ever happened to an American nuclear plant. Coal plants in Michigan are closing, but electricity demand is rising. Nick Culp of Holtec, the company that owns Palisades, says nuclear can help fill the gap without contributing to climate change.
Michigan used to be more than 50% coal generation maybe 15 years ago. How do you backfill that when you see demand on the horizon, like AI, like data storage centers, like keeping the lights on at home and for new manufacturing?
So how do you actually bring a reactor out of retirement? It starts with the staff. Jim Bird is the plant's assistant operations manager. He had moved on to a nuclear plant in Mississippi after Palisades closed 3 years ago.
When they started hiring back up, I got a very quick call, interested in coming back, and I said, yes, I'm coming home. Palisades is my home. These people are my family.
And that work family is growing.
We'll come on cool. back here.
Bird shows me the training center, an exact replica of the reactor control room, right down to its 1960s pink and green color scheme.
Right now they're going through, this is one of my initial classes, and they're doing abnormal operating procedures. We're going through training them. If this event happens, here's what we do.
Bird says he and his colleagues know how to run trainings. But recommissioning is something no one has done before.
I had existing licensed operators that had a license from the NRC when we shut down. We had to work on getting those back. We had to reconstitute the simulator. When we came back, there was over 20 missing parts in there that we had to put back in and get it back to the standards that you need to do to be able to test them. Just exactly like they were when we shut down.
All that work is worth it, he says, to get the plant back up and running.
What we're doing here is exciting. We may be the first, we won't be the last. Having a reliable power source that keeps your electricity costs low, everybody should be rooting for that.
Leaving the plant, everyone has to go through a radiation portal monitor, like a walk-through metal detector, but for radioactivity.
3, 2, 1, clean.
Safety is, of course, a major concern for nuclear power plants. Regulators require plants to have an emergency plan for a 10-mile zone around each reactor. Bird points out he and a lot of plant employees live within that zone. So does Dewey Cook.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm Chris Bentley, looking for Dewey Cook.
She's the township supervisor of Covert, Michigan. Her family has been in the area for generations. Her dad actually helped build Palisades 60 years ago. And she says the plant has been an economic lifeline ever since.
Having that stability and having that employment available for folks who live here is something that I think was taken for granted for a very long time.
Taxes from Palisades at one point made up 40% of the township's revenue. So Cook and others around Covert are happy to see it coming back. Money is one thing. What about safety?
Absolutely. I think you'd have to be pretty naive to not think about that a little bit. So I grew up with the sirens being tested. I think it was every last Saturday of the month growing up, and it was just a normal thing. But, you know, we always knew it was there. And because you had so many people who worked there and understood the plant and understood that industry, I think that helped a lot, that, you know, education is key to understanding why people fear things like nuclear energy.
Do you feel totally safe?
I don't feel totally safe because I don't think you can 100% trust any sort of technology, whether it be from a gas plant or a nuclear power plant or any sort of large industry. But I think what's important is that Holtec continues to be a good neighbor.
Another nuclear power plant that shut down and is in the process of coming back is a name you might have heard before, Three Mile Island in central Pennsylvania. From the banks of the Susquehanna River, just south of Harrisburg, you can see the cooling towers rising from Three Mile Island, which was home to the worst nuclear disaster in American history in the 1970s. One of the reactors on the island had a partial meltdown, and in fact, the incident helped close a chapter in the history of American nuclear power. But the other reactor on the island kept going and produced power until 2019 when it shut down for financial reasons. That reactor, like Palisades in western Michigan, is in the process of coming back online.
When the plant was operating, I was a licensed senior reactor operator.
Craig Smith is one of the people in charge of the recommissioning on Three Mile Island. He was in high school in nearby Hershey during the partial meltdown in 1979. He still lives within the plant's evacuation zone and says he was sad to see the remaining reactor close in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, I understood the decision. I wasn't bitter about it. It's an economic decision, right? It was eerie, right? I mean, when you walk through the plant now, it's all the equipment's still there, but it's deathly quiet, right? You don't hear the hum of, you know, of the motors, the steam going through the lines and all that kind of stuff. So it's an eerie kind of feeling when you walk through the plant.
That eerie feeling will be gone soon. A red LCD clock in Smith's office counts down the 540 days or so until the plant's scheduled reopening in late 2027, which, like the restart of Palisades in Michigan, is backed by federal loans. The recommissioned plant on Three Mile Island, renamed the Crane Clean Energy Center, will pump 800 megawatts into the regional grid. But all that electricity is spoken for. Microsoft agreed to buy an equivalent amount for the next 20 years to power its data centers. Smith says that's a sign of how fast things are changing in the energy industry.
The nuclear renaissance, I've seen three or four of them in my career, but we need to keep a balanced portfolio of generation. You can't have all your eggs in one basket for generation. So I think it's great for the country to have nuclear able to be a baseload for the future.
Gene Stilp has a different take.
The people here, who are they here to serve? The shareholders of Constellation and Microsoft, or the people who live here? And so we're sticking up for the people who live here rather than the shareholders of Microsoft and Constellation.
Stilp has been fighting nuclear power on Three Mile Island since before the plant opened in the 70s and says recommissioning is an unnecessary risk to public safety. To make his point, he takes me to the Penn State Hershey Medical Center, a major hospital complex within the plant's evacuation zone. He's wearing a blazer with no TMI restart sewn in the back.
What they're proposing for evacuation does not work, and so that's my line in the sand. Population increases in central Pennsylvania, the realization that there are so many people at risk here, the best thing to do is to take away that risk, eliminate the risk. That's where I stand.
And Stilp is not alone. Eric Epstein runs a group called Three Mile Island Alert. At a coffee shop down the street from the Pennsylvania state capitol, he says the country is making mistakes in its rush to power data centers.
There was no public discussion about whether or not we're going to restart Three Mile Island. We're going to do it. Tech bros are into it. We're going to do it. You know, it's like America loves a Hollywood ending. There ain't no Hollywood ending to nuclear power. You get electricity for a moment, but you get nuclear waste forever. Forever is a long time.
Epstein says the economics might have changed for nuclear power, but the risks have not.
You know, you can put all the green paint you want on nuclear power. There has been no viable solution to isolate nuclear waste. Who in their right mind would store nuclear waste on an island in a river that floods, that empties into the Chesapeake Bay?
Constellation says the spent fuel on site has been safely stored on the island for decades in fortified containers required by the government to withstand natural disasters. But those concerns are not lost on Dauphin County Commissioner Justin Douglas.
I personally am very interested in transparency and accountability for this, in the sense of, you know, ensuring that it's as safe as it possibly can be, that we're tracking the cost and ensuring that the taxpayers aren't carrying any of the burden, that we have a good plan for the waste management, and that ultimately the community impact is positive. We plan for the worst and we hope for the best, right?
So how big of a solution is recommissioning anyway? Meeting the country's rising demand for electricity will take a lot more than reviving a few recently decommissioned plants. But it's a lot faster than building new ones. There are also technical updates that can squeeze more power out of some existing plants. And all that will help blunt the immediate electricity crunch from AI and data centers, says Jacopo Bongiorno of MIT.
Realistically, in the next 5 years, nuclear could capture 20% of that demand. If that demand continues in the 2030s, then you can make the investment now to build new reactors, and then nuclear can actually capture a lot more than 20%.
If nuclear is going to meet rising electricity demand in the long term, it's going to mean a lot more new reactors going up all over the country. So while Western Michigan and Central Pennsylvania may be the first communities asking whether that's a good investment, they will not be the last. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Bentley.
Tomorrow we're going to take a closer look at what it would take to build new nuclear plants. It won't be easy. Our reverse course reporting on climate solutions at hereandnow.org.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Josie Guarino. Democrat Mark Vesey of Texas is the latest lawmaker to say he'll leave Congress after his district was one of several in Texas redrawn to favor Republicans. The seven-term congressman says he'll instead run for Tarrant County Judge. The U.S. Supreme Court this month allowed the challenged Texas congressional redistricting plan to be used in next year's election, overturning a lower court ruling that the map likely discriminates on the basis of race. President Trump is heading to Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania later today to discuss his administration's efforts to address a top concern for voters, affordability. The president has said the Democrats caused the affordability problem. He also said that his administration is working to fix it. Recent polls show voters blame the president's policies for high prices. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. is concerned by an uptick in fighting between Cambodia and Thailand along their contested border, less than 2 months after the two countries signed a peace deal in Malaysia with President Trump. The Cambodia-Thailand deal, one of several Trump has hailed as evidence of his negotiating abilities, has been faltering for weeks. 5 days of fighting since has left dozens dead on both sides. You're listening to Here and Now.
Afternoon support for KQED comes from Peninsula Lively Arts, presenting Hip Hop Nutcracker, a spin on a holiday favorite with beloved music and fresh moves. December 20th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center. Details at peninsulalivelyarts.org. Visitorscoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com. Some of that fog still hanging around parts of the Bay Area and the Sacramento Valley into the afternoon, especially far inland. A mix of cloud, sun, and some fog. Bay Area highs 50s to the 60s. Looking ahead, quiet weather with warmer temperatures slowly increasing through Friday, and then light rain is possible next week.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, Storyworth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at storyworth.com.
It's here and now. The future of Warner Brothers Discovery, one of the defining film studios of the past century, hangs in the balance. Netflix announced a deal last Friday to take over the entertainment giant. Hollywood was already reacting to a streamer taking over a company that actually still made films for theaters. But then yesterday, Paramount announced a hostile takeover bid of the company as well. Now, if you're reaching back to the 1970s and 80s to remind yourself, what is that again? Well, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi there.
So what does hostile takeover mean, hostile being the key word?
It brings to mind the famous lyric, how can we be lovers if we can't be friends?
Yes,
and so if somebody courting a company is not getting time of day from management, feels jilted, we'll go straight to shareholders with an offer. We'll try to go over management's head. Brings to mind Gordon Gekko and the greed is good speech,
right,
trying to shame that management and go straight to shareholders. And so that's not a friendly engagement. That's a hostile offer.
Well, and this is, it seems, what Paramount is looking to do. Paramount CEO David Ellison said Monday on CNBC, we are offering shareholders $17.6 billion more cash than the deal they currently have signed up with Netflix. We believe when they see what's currently in our offer, that's what they'll vote for. So that can be a tender offer. But also you might try to convince shareholders to vote on replacing the board itself in a proxy fight.
Yeah, the irony is there's nothing tender or engaging about it, right? I always used to laugh at this kind of stuff because you as the shareholder, assuming you're paying attention to this one holding and all the different material you're going to get from this management, from the outside proxy company, from the fund company, if you have it with Fidelity or Vanguard or something, you just kind of tune it out. You're like, well, this thing is being bought. I could have already sold the share. So this is assuming that you're paying enough granular detail to take the company up on its outside offer and tender your shares so they get enough clout, in this case, the Ellisons, to force Warner to come to the table and negotiate with them.
Right. But Ken, so what, but the part about trying to get shareholders or, yeah, shareholders to vote against the board, what would they then do? You know, replace the board with a board that
Your share is your vote.
I got
in a shareholder democracy. So if you're selling your shares to the Ellisons in this tender offer directly to them, they can then say, look, you're not as omnipotent as you are. We have a vote. We have a popular vote out there. Why don't you come to the table or else I can go hostile again. I can up the offer again. What it typically does is it forces a conversation where, in this case, Warner management has otherwise tuned out the Ellisons.
Okay. And by the way, do these takeover companies ever try to stack the shareholders before they make this move? Or?
Yeah, they can. What they do is in modern times, they'll buy a chunk of shares and come out. And there's a gray area. They'll call themselves activists. Investors. I'm torchbearers for a shareholder democracy, and I'm doing what's right. In the end, it's always trying to affix yourself to management's ankle to try to get something that you otherwise wouldn't be able to get.
Yeah, and how common is this?
How common? We used to see it a lot in the 1980s, clearly culminating with 1988's acquisition of RJR Nabisco. I mean, I think there's an HBO send-up of that for nearly $25 billion. The Ellisons themselves did it with Oracle. Larry Ellison did with PeopleSoft. You did see some hostility with Elon Musk and Twitter.
Right.
In general, it's not that common because it's unwieldy. Typically, you want to work with management. Typically, you want to say, I'm your friend, and then bring them in and then lay everybody off.
Yeah, it just doesn't feel right. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Hamas says it is willing to lay down its weapons after 2 years of war in Gaza, but under what conditions? NPR spoke with two Hamas officials about that and about the group's decision to attack Israel 2 years ago on October 7th. That story and more on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition starts at 2 o'clock after BBC Overnight News. Join us at 2 until 9 a.m. for Wednesday morning. It's a tense day at the Good Karma Hospital. Lydia and Marie clash over how to best support Jyoti. AJ takes on a patient with mysterious abdominal pain, and Ruby, still shaken by everything that happened with Gabriel, struggles to find her footing again. Don't miss the season finale of Good Karma Hospital tonight at 8 p.m. on KQED+. Support for KQED comes from Postman, used by over 40 million developers and 98% of the Fortune 500. Postman offers a platform where teams build APIs that help AI agents and humans make smarter decisions. Postman.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and from Rhodes Scholar, celebrating 50 years of transformative learning adventures for adults in over 100 countries. Learn more at rhodesscholar.org/explore. And City Space Productions, WBUR's creative studio for custom podcasts that tell a brand story to ignite engagement, reach new audiences, or establish thought leadership. WBUR.org/creative studio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. Healthcare is a huge piece of the American economy. It's almost a fifth of all the spending in this country, and that figure has risen sharply in recent decades. It's helped revive former industrial downtowns in places like Cleveland and Buffalo. It's also come along with steep increases in how much Americans pay for healthcare, despite seeing worse health outcomes than most other developed nations. And one place where that disparity is impossible to ignore is Albany, Georgia. ProPublica's Ginger Thompson has spent years reporting from there to try to answer this question. Why are people in Albany so sick when its most powerful institution is a hospital? Ginger Thompson, welcome to Here and Now. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
So Albany, Georgia, you reported on this town during the pandemic because it had the fourth highest per capita rate of infection in the world. What did you see? Let's start there. During the pandemic, what did you see?
Albany is this very unlikely. It is as unlikely a hotspot as anyone can imagine. It's so small and so remote and so untouched by time that its own residents often joke about how little happens there, saying that when the world ends, Albany's the place to be because the end won't get there for another 20 years. So it was this place that did not expect to be walloped the way that it was.
Well, the fact is, you going to do this story and learning about this hospital led to something much, much deeper, and that's what we're here to talk about today. At what point do you realize that your story is much more than COVID?
What I learned was that the city had sort of been battling more entrenched health crises for decades. The most important social determinant of health, of course, is access to care. And in that way, Albany seemed really lucky because it had Phoebe, right? It had this world-class, sprawling nonprofit health system that had 691 beds, all kinds of specialty care, and that had also become the largest provider of health care and the largest property owner in Albany, Georgia, also the largest employer. So the first thing I learned is that, you know, just because a town has a hospital doesn't mean that everyone has access to care, right? And Phoebe's particularly interesting in this way. It was founded in 1911 on a mission that it would serve everyone, no matter race or ability to pay, which really put it ahead of its time when it was founded. But until recently, there was also a free clinic located across the street from the hospital. And on my very first visit to that clinic, the man who came in for help was wearing a Phoebe uniform. He worked as a groundskeeper at the hospital, and he'd had a badly infected tooth. He had suffered with this thing for a week. I asked him whether he had tried to get help at Phoebe, and he told me he had gone to the emergency room there, but the nurses gave him a prescription and a list of dentists and sent him on his way. And neither one of those slips of paper were useful to him because he didn't have insurance, so he couldn't afford the meds and he couldn't afford a dentist. And so I said to myself, you know, what is it? You have a safety net hospital that actually still needs a safety net. And when I asked the CEO at Phoebe about this groundskeeper, he sort of point blank told me that the healthcare system isn't really set up to help everyone. That, sure, Phoebe has this mission that it will provide care to everyone, no matter their race and no matter their ability to pay, but it can't serve everyone because he's got bills to pay too.
Ginger, what strikes me about this situation is that this hospital system was sprawling. It was had such a prominent role in the community. It employed so many people in this community, and yet that didn't even seem to give it the same benefit as other industries might.
You know, when it comes to lifting unskilled workers out of poverty, hospital jobs are not like manufacturing jobs, right? At a place like Cooper Tire, which was, you know, had some 1,300 workers in Albany before it closed, an unskilled worker could make $20 an hour, right? At Phoebe, an unskilled worker was making less than half that when I first got there. And I learned about a woman who had worked at Phoebe named Louise Williams, right? She was the only person at Phoebe to die from the pandemic in 2020. And she worked in what was called their environmental services crew, which is sort of a fancy term for the people that clean and disinfect patient rooms, right? Phoebe paid tribute to her after the pandemic by refurbishing the environmental services break room, and they rechristened it as Wheezy's Place. But when I met Louise Williams' family, they told me that she died deeply in debt. She had worked at Phoebe for 20 years and earned $9.75 an hour, more or less. She was barely able to afford to feed her grandkids, and she even had medical debt when she died. You know, it's just the kind of people who are in Albany who don't have college degrees. Lifting those people out of poverty is harder when your economy is dominated by a hospital.
I'm speaking with ProPublica's Ginger Thompson about a hospital town in rural Georgia. And Ginger, you write in the piece that we cling to this idea of our healthcare system as a public service because that is often how hospitals portray themselves. You know, if we go back to this idea of COVID, we called them heroes, and certainly they were in many cases. Hospitals save lives. But you also, I think you've just been laying out the point here in our conversation that hospitals are also first and foremost a business. It sounds like that's what's driving what's happening in
Albany. That is the central sort of characteristic of our healthcare system. It's that our hospitals are businesses first. One of the things I quickly learned about Albany, Georgia, is that for decades, that county, Daugherty County, which is one of the poorest counties in Georgia and in the South, pays some of the highest costs for healthcare in the country. I mean, it was sort of second or third to resort areas like Vail, Colorado, and Aspen.
Wow.
Albany, Georgia, and the people in Albany, Georgia, pay higher rates for health care and for health insurance than people did in those communities.
So this is a five-part series. The reporting is incredibly in-depth, and you spoke briefly about the hospital's reaction to the man who went to the clinic with the toothache, but I'm curious what else the hospital told you in response to some of the things you're talking about here, because I'm sure they would defend their position not only in the community but as providers of healthcare.
Well, look, I should say that Joel Wernick, the CEO who ran Phoebe for much of the time that is covered in the story, never responded to my emails, to my phone calls, or my FedExes, and I think that speaks volumes about his management of the hospital. Scott Steiner, however, who is the current CEO at Phoebe Putney, was responsive throughout my reporting, and while he, you know, was very enthusiastic about the idea of us reporting on Phoebe when he thought we were writing about the heroics of their COVID response, he became less enthusiastic when I began to say that my story would sort of try to take on the history of the hospital's relationship with Albany. And I think it was, you know, it's been a very tough history. There have been very few towns in the country that have fought as vigorously over health care, over the cost of care, over the quality of care as Albany, Georgia. There have been Supreme Court cases around it. There have been feature-length documentaries around this question. This has been a fight that this town has, you know, that has polarized this town for a very long time. And I think Steiner was, you know, reluctant to open old wounds by having me sort of take a look at this history.
ProPublica's Ginger Thompson. We're going to link you to her series at hereandnow.org. It's called Sick in a Hospital Town. Ginger, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from TheaterWorks Silicon Valley, presenting Georgiana and Kitty, Christmas at Pemberley. This holiday sequel to Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice performs through December 28th at Palo Alto's Lucy Stern Theater. Info at theaterworks.org. And by Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. Here and now until the top of the hour, all things considered, KQED Afternoon News at 1, followed at 2 by The World.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and Olin College of Engineering. They believe human-centered designs make the most meaningful impact. At Olin, students learn to work in partnership with local communities with humility and empathy. Olin.edu. And the Museum of Science, Boston, where visitors can experience live presentations with indoor lightning storms, animals, robotics, and hands-on design challenges. Learn more at mos.org.
It's Here and Now. A Watergate-era rule on campaign spending may be on the chopping block at the Supreme Court. The court has already loosened different restrictions on money in elections, but it's now weighing a limit on how much money political parties can spend in coordination with a candidate. And there are some concerns that if the court strikes down that limit, it could give more power to big donors who might expect a quid pro quo. This is Richard Breifold's wheelhouse. He's a professor at Columbia Law School. And Professor, today's case jumps off a case from the 70s. The dairy industry wanted to write a huge check to then-President Nixon's campaign in exchange for price supports on milk. Federal law limited the amount that could be donated to the candidate. So Nixon's people came up with a workaround. What was the workaround?
Well, so the idea was that they would funnel it through the party, through the Republican Party at that time.
Yeah, and would get it to Nixon.
Right.
And yet the quid pro quo would still be understood.
Yes, but your key point is that it wasn't literal, it wasn't expressed, but it would be understood, exactly.
Yeah, and this was all revealed during the Watergate hearings. So Congress then passed a law. What did that law do?
The law was part of the overall package of campaign finance reforms that Congress enacted in 1974. This particular provision limits the amount of money parties can spend in coordination with a candidate. The key word is coordination. The party would do the spending, but it would be doing it talking to the candidate and working out with the candidate where they would spend it, what the message would be.
So, again, to be clear, a large donor can give some money to the Republican Party, but what, they would not be expected to tell the candidate where the money came from?
Well, there are rules that are called earmarking rules. So when the donor gives money to the party, the donor cannot literally earmark and say, this money is for candidate so-and-so.
Well, Professor, that does seem kind of flimsy. You know, I mean, what is your sense of that? Like, would the party kind of know who the donor wanted the money to go to?
Yes, exactly. And the party would often be raising money to help specific candidates. No, it is everyone knows what's going on, even if there's not formal or official earmarking.
Well, but what is the case that, you know, then-Senator J.D. Vance and other candidates made in this case when it started in 2022? Because they didn't point that out, that it, you know, kind of was a flimsy firewall. But they were talking about things like First Amendment rights.
Right. So their argument is that basically the parties have free speech rights, and the parties should be free to spend their money in support of candidates, and that the most effective way to do that is to do it by coordinating with a candidate.
The New York Times is reporting today that if the court sides with the Republicans backing this, it could hurt Democrats more because it would expand the influence of big money. Democrats have done better at winning smaller donations in recent years. But do you think it could lead to the kind of quid pro quo deals that the dairy industry was looking for, funneling money to Richard Nixon in exchange for something?
Well, for sure. I mean, this is becomes yet another way of big donors having influence in politics. They have many other ways of doing it. So those kinds of deals may be already happening, but this would create one more opportunity to make a large contribution to a political party that the political party could then in turn use working with a candidate to advance, to help that candidate win an election.
Professor, in 2010, the court ruled in Citizens United that corporations and unions can indirectly spend unlimited money in campaigns. That paved the way for super PACs. We know former Wisconsin Democratic Senator Russ Feingold wrote a brief in this case the court is considering right now. He was part of McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform. That's been partly overturned. He said getting rid of these limits, that we're talking about today of parties, would be the next step in the march toward allowing unlimited money to swamp American elections. This is perhaps the cynic in me, and I'm maybe guessing it's in listeners. I mean, is this something that's just doomed? Water under the bridge, it's already happening.
Well, there's a lot to that. I mean, the Supreme Court has been embarked on basically a almost 20-year project starting in the mid-2000s to kind of dismantle the campaign finance laws. A lot has already happened, and you mentioned Citizens United, increased corporate and union participation, super PACs, and the ability of very wealthy individuals, either as individuals or in PACs, to raise and spend a lot of money in connection with elections. We saw that in the last presidential election. This would be one more step in that direction. And indeed, interestingly, the lawyer for the challenger, plaintiffs in this case, was saying, well, one of the limits on here is that there are still limits on how much individuals can give to parties. And then he was being pressed by some of the justices, well, are those constitutional? And he basically said, well, we're not going to address that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And basically saying, I'm not precluding myself from raising that in the future. So I think this is one more step in a series of steps in which the Supreme Court has been, over time, knocking out a lot of the campaign finance laws. Would this decision here make things worse, maybe at the margins? It will be easier for donors to give money to parties and for the parties then to work directly with candidates, but a lot of that money, candidly, is already getting into elections.
Richard Berfalt, professor at Columbia Law School, thank you so much.
Sure, my pleasure.
Okay. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Mehrotra Institute at Boston University, hosting the Is Business Broken podcast, featuring conversations with academics, industry leaders, and politicians. More at ibms.bu.edu.
I'm Farida Javala Romero, and I'm a labor correspondent at KQED. A lot of my stories are about communities of color, many of them immigrants. And with these stories, we can build a bridge to have that connection, you know, connecting different communities that may not be talking to each other directly because we all make the Bay Area what it is. Help KQED keep public media free and accessible. Donate today at kqed.org/donate.
We have connected again with Julie Debish at the KQED traffic desk with details about a problem in San Jose.
There's a new wreck there on northbound 280 before Guadalupe Parkway. Couple vehicles, one still blocking the right lane, so it is a backup to 7th Street. A stall in San Jose and southbound 680 after Allen Rock Avenue. That car did make it over to the shoulder now. And a little trouble at the Bay Bridge Toll Plaza heading in the westbound direction. Two vehicle wreck there on the shoulder. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Afternoon traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco International Airport. SFO travelers can check off their first holiday to-do by booking convenient parking near the terminals in advance. Learn more at flysfo.com/parking. I'm Dave.